Wednesday. Some of you know, this last Wednesday was my 25th anniversary of ordination, and I think it's appropriate to thank Sangha and Sanghas everywhere for making that life possible. So I want to thank all of you. By that life, I don't just mean my situation. I mean a life that can be somewhat explicitly founded on Buddha's teaching. Not that the results are always that attractive, but anyway, the possibility exists. And to some degree, my winding up in that place, this place, was a little bit by default. It was an idea I had when I was in high school. When I was 15, I thought, I think I'll be a monk. A Buddhist monk, to the scandal of my Catholic parents. So I don't know where that idea came from exactly, but there was a lot of neurosis mixed in there, as there still is. But over the years, some of that has been able to tease some of that out. And in the process, the call to have that way of life persisted. Also, some other things didn't work out. I didn't get rich. my marriage blew up, and various other things didn't that might have, I don't know, kept me on a different course, didn't. So I kept settling back to some place of not being so interested in a life where practicing together with people in a physical and obvious way wasn't kind of the main thing. So, and there isn't any such thing without people like yourselves. So I'm very grateful. The temples, you know, they do fail. You know? They do come to an end, like all other human institutions and phenomena. And there certainly have been times when it felt like our little temple was edging that way. Now it doesn't feel like that so much. I received that chat message from my friends who are in France. And he said, oh, we're at this magnificent abbey. And I said, oh, cool, do they have beer? And he said, oh, no, it's totally abandoned. It's this magnificent place falling into ruin. Probably since the French Revolution or so, maybe. So these things happen, and what prevents it from happening, of course, is people who bring their living bodies, their lives together to meet one another and to encounter the great matter, as we say in Buddhism, study the great matter. One of my inspirations was the gent whose picture's on the altar there, Isan Dorsey. And in the 70s, somewhere in the maybe mid 70s, 1970s, when he was what they were calling at the time Summer Shuso, that is, he was the kind of head monastic at Tassajara. And in those days, the heavies, like the abbot, they didn't necessarily show up much in the summer. So that meant that the Summer Shuso was in charge of a lot of stuff. And So when I was there as a guest student for, you know, a couple of weeks or something, I would just sort of trail around after him and watch him do stuff and go hang out with him. He was very, very, people who know him, he was very generous with his time. And you could drop in on him and chat or have tea or whatever. And that was a great inspiration. And at the time, I was relatively new, coming out of the closet and facing some of the challenges involved with that. And at the time, I had a prominent earring, and and the Eno told me I had to take it off. So I went whining to Isan and said, "He told me I had to take my earring off." And Isan said, "Don't worry, I'll talk to him about it." And I got to wear my earring in the Zendo by Isan's intervention. I also told him, you know, I kind of want to be a monk, but there's this sex thing happening. Well, it's kind of powerful. And I don't know what I expected him to say, but he said something like, "Oh, don't worry about that so much. It's not as important as you think." I went, "What? It's not? Surely, you know." But anyway, that was his advice. He also said, you know, don't let that keep you from jumping into your practice with both feet, he said. He said, "If you do, you'll never be satisfied if you let that stop you." And I don't know if that made a big impression at the time, but I realized I've never forgotten it. And he was right. So, you know, whether we're, quote, monk or quote, layperson or whatever, our lives are a complicated business, and a very, very deep and demanding study. And if we don't do that study, we'll never be satisfied. There'll always be a feeling of some piece missing somewhere. These questions that are unedifying if they don't have a solid basis in practice or cultivation, like, what's it all about? What's the meaning of it all? It's like, they're a total waste of time if they're not rooted in something, some kind of study or investigation or discipline or yoga, something that allows us to turn away from our obsession with the superficial and remind us and reveal to us how deep our life actually is. So there are, of course, various ways of this kind of study, and humans have been doing this for as long as they've been humans, probably. Our way is just to sit down in the midst of life and study without bringing any particular, gadgetry or, as I sometimes say, technology, without bringing much baggage with us. In fact, as much as possible, leaving baggage aside and using what I guess we could say is just a minimal yogic foundation. That's all. And then train and also trust ourselves just to observe and feel the power of those samskaras, those karmic currents that are constantly trying to move us in one direction or another, towards or away, over and over and over again. and to take our seat in the midst of all of that amazing activity and simply watch. I was going to say, I almost said opens the mind's eye, but that's not right. That is the mind's eye open to do that already. You don't do that so that my mind's eye will open and then I will see rainbows everywhere. It's not like that at all. Our practice is the practice of the mind's eye open. This is the basis, the heart of our sitting. This is also another way of, Dogen says a little differently, practice verification, one thing. And of course, you all are verifying that for yourselves. There's a funny, actually quite a few funny passages. I don't mean funny ha-ha, I mean funny weird passages in the Shurangama Sutra, which is itself, as you may know, Dogen actually mistrusted it. And so did Rujing. They felt it was not a forgery exactly, but something falsely attributed to Buddha. And of course, that was, 800 or more years ago. And today, a certain large group of scholars feel that it was actually, it's a Chinese composition and was not, there is no Indian original. But there's nonetheless a lot of strange and interesting stuff in it. There's one extremely long mantra. In Chinese, it's like 5,000 characters. And did you say that? Did you guys recite that at Fo Guanshan? Yeah, it's like every day at 10,000 Buddhas, they go, it's just like amazing. You cannot follow it, at least I could not. Even if it's printed out in English, it just goes too fast. But there's other stuff in there, and snippets of dialogue between Buddha and Ananda and stuff. And one says, little quote they made into incorporated in a Zen story, sometimes called a koan, both in the Book of Serenity and the Blue Cliff Record. And Buddha is saying, when I don't see, why don't you see my not seeing? If you see my not seeing, that is not, there is no distinguishing characteristic of not seeing there. If you don't see my not seeing, that's nothing at all. Here's the kicker. How could it not be you? Kind of weird, huh?
What was the last, you or you?
How could it not be you?
You?
You. How could it not be you? So I'll say it again. It is strange. When I don't see, meaning, basically, there's a larger dialogue between Ananda and Buddha, where Buddha says, Ananda asks him some question, and Buddha says, I see the incense burner. And Ananda says, I see the incense burner too. So I see Buddha seeing. And Buddha like closes his eyes or turns away and says, I don't see the incense burner. And Ananda says, I also don't see the incense burner. That's seeing Buddha. This isn't sounding very Indian, not to my ears. This sounds already kind of Chinese. The background of Taoist thinking in there somewhere. But it also reflects, interestingly, some of the atmosphere of Indian scholastic thinking where seeing and not seeing are phenomena. And especially, of course, we know seeing is a dharma. And in the Heart Sutra, what do we say? We say, there's no sight. There's no eye. There's no sound. There's no ear, and so forth. So this is taking that a little bit further and saying, the Heart Sutra says, seeing is empty. What about not seeing? When I'm not seeing, do you see my not seeing? If you do, it's a little funny. And then if you don't, that's nothing at all. And then they turn it completely around and say, how could that not be you? How could all of this elaborate phenomenal expression not be you? How easy it is to get lost in the byways of seeing, not seeing, eyes, no eyes, form, emptiness, blah, blah, blah. And to forget that how could it not be you? So very often, you know, a lot of these stories will kind of take us in one direction and then suddenly flip the arrow around till it's pointing right back here. Right back to the only place of study there is. If I close my eyes and I don't see you guys, are you seeing? Am I not seeing? Not really. Then if you're not seeing my not seeing, that's nothing at all. So, where are you? How could it not be us? Inherent in this little discussion or this quote from the sutra, you know, is the necessity of renunciation. And as I was telling Nadine yesterday, it's not often recognized how severe the asceticism of this practice is. This one. Usually, people think of asceticism, you know, they think of those harsh monasteries with people running around with sticks, screaming and smacking you on the head. But to sit with nothing is an extraordinary asceticism. Talking about this story, Tian Tong says, the ocean dries up, space is filled. Namely, there's nothing more. There are no loopholes. And if there's one thing our sitting teaches us, it's that there are no loopholes worthy of the name. Yeah, there are loopholes. And they all lead to what? More birth and death. Every one of them leads deeper into samsara. Now, we don't mind so much, as bodhisattvas because that's where we work. But it's good to know that. Like, do you think you see a loophole? Where do you think it leads? I'll tell you. Six realms. Over and over and over again. So better to do the study that doesn't lead that way. That drains the ocean and fills all of space. And we call that, well, just sit. That's how the ocean is drained. Space is full of ungraspable phenomena. Seeing, not seeing, eyes, ears, nose, etc., etc. All of it phenomenal, all of it ungraspable. Thank you for supporting this practice with your bodies, your lives. It's pretty amazing. And probably in various ways, people are, beings are thanking you already for it. Besides me, other beings. And probably in ways that you don't notice. And that's probably just as well. If the thanks, the inconceivable return of this practice were an object of our consciousness, it might start to throw us off a little bit. We might start to really get into that. Oh, look how many beings are thanking me. This is kind of cool. I think maybe I'll keep this up. Louder, please. Louder. So that wouldn't be so good. So it's better if it's not even an object of our consciousness. And someone says, well, thank you. You say, oh, you're welcome. That's it. Good part about being the person giving the Dharma talk is you can stop basically when you want. It's not like a news show where you have to fill up 40 minutes with news. So I'm done, but we'll have the memorial, monthly memorial for Isan right after this, and David, who was of course ordained by Isan, will be Doshi, and I hope you can stay for that. And if you do, we'll give you cookies after. And it's also a very short ceremony, and we get to chant this wonderful poem, The Merging of Difference and Unity, or whatever it's called. Harmony of Difference and Equality, or the Sando Kai, which is a magnificent poem, jam-packed with teaching. And it's also pretty short. So, but have some questions or comments? Yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. When you said to the nature metaphor of draining the ocean,
draining the ocean,
and
filling space,
mm-hmm. And the space is filled with ungraspable concepts. Can you just tell me a little bit with the ocean metaphor of why draining the ocean, what it represents?
Well, I think they just. Both those together represent the same thing. I don't think they're leaning too heavily on the elemental qualities of earth and water, or air and water or whatever. I think they're referring to, draining the ocean is a way of talking about ending involvement with phenomena, and filling space. There's another way of talking about there's nothing to be brought in. So that's how I see these metaphors. busy involvement with phenomena drains away, and there's nothing that needs to be brought in. It's all there already. So that's how it strikes me anyway. I'm not saying that's right, but that's...
No, that's okay. Yeah. And then the second part was the six the six realms?
Yes.
Do you think they could correspond to consciousnesses? I mean, sorry, this might be... It was just when you said that, because I've been thinking about it, you know, the hell realms, greedy, the hungry ghosts, arrogance.
Yes.
Do you ever see any correspondence?
Oh, yes.
You know, all these things, these systems seem to eventually...
Well, they all come back to... What do they come back to? How could it not be you? Exactly. And it's okay to think of it in cosmological terms, that there's our realm and then there's five others around somewhere. But it's also just as appropriate and maybe more useful to think of it in terms of these are phenomenal expressions of consciousness and being that we go through all the time, all the time. And some people seem to spend a lot more time in one realm than another, but everyone is constantly making the circuit until they're not. Does that speak to your question? Yes,
Jim. First of all, congratulations on your 25th anniversary.
Thank you. I didn't think I'd make it, actually. I thought I was going to die. And I was surprised when I didn't. And not displeased.
We're glad you made it.
Yeah, thank you.
And as always, thank you for your teaching. When you were talking about seeing, I realized yesterday that we don't know what we see when we say we see something anyway. And it happened to be that young lady that was at Zazen yesterday, and she was moving around a lot, and I, of course, was thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turned out she was had been very severely injured and not expected to ever walk again.
Wow.
And so it made me realize I didn't see what I was thinking I saw at all.
Right, right.
You know, and I became so amazed because Jennifer was so gracious to speak with her and find out her story.
Yeah, good for you.
Both of them actually had been paraplegic. Wow. Both those women.
Had been paraplegic?
They met in rehab.
Good grief.
And support each other.
Wow.
One's practice, that was the one woman's first time sitting.
Amazing.
The other one's practice.
Wow. Yeah.
But it was very moving to uncover, so thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah. And often enough, what we see is what we get, so we should be careful with our seeing.
Also, another question, this may be beyond, maybe another Dharma talk or Jim's neuroses, could be that too. But I hear sometimes that everything is Zazen.
Mm-hmm.
And when we speak about sitting practice and studying ourselves, and how does that differ, or is that different than everything is Zazen? I just struggle with this over and over.
Mm-hmm. I think everything is Zazen is a little bit of a shorthand expression, and which is okay, but it kind of obscures a little bit because it's a little too short. And it's okay for the konyoshenti, the initiates. Well, I know what that means, but other people might be a little confused by that. Any moment of consciousness can and does have that quality of studying the self, or just this, or ordinary mind is Buddha. So this means that Zazen, as Dogen explicitly says, is not limited to sitting or some posture or some ritual observance. It is always right there where we are. So that's the sense of that. And to actually kind of take that on and be inspired by that and move with that is to be practicing, quote, practicing Zazen, unquote, all the time. And this, of course, reveals that there is no gap between the Zendo and out there, which is extremely important for us practitioners. Otherwise, it's kind of weird what we do. You know, what's the good of sitting in the basement on a cushion in the dark? Well, it's raining out, so maybe we're lucky, we're dry. But beyond that, is there any point in doing this? Well, yeah, the point is to realize there isn't that gap. The point is to understand in our own body what it means to say everything is Zazen. And that's very, very powerful and important. So the qualities that we may be come acquainted with in our sitting practice, eventually we realize are available every moment, all the time, everywhere, every circumstance. So that's the meaning of everything is Zazen, and it is that's a very, very powerful and important teaching. And as a result, those teachings, you know, we have to be a little careful with. So I don't know if it'd be good to walk up and down Castro Street saying, "Hey, everybody, everything's Zazen." I mean, they might, that might be good, but some people might get the wrong idea and do some weird stuff with that. So that's why it's, you know, there's this funny business about how open should we be with our teaching and practice. Well, in a way, we should be totally open all the time, but sometimes that causes trouble for people. So there is a little bit of this quasi-initiatory quality or experience around, particularly Zen and some other traditions, that try to minimize the possibility of damage that these very powerful teachings can do if they're not the right medicine for that patient. And it requires some care. So I feel safe you having that teaching, but if you share it with others, try to get them to get the longer view there, the whole view.
Sometimes yes. I find this everything is Zazen approach to be helpful. Mm-hmm. Like in moments of stress,
yeah.
Especially at work, when people are asking me questions I can't answer.
Yes.
I just want to tell them to go away.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of a learning experience. You know, it is helpful sometimes.
Yeah, well, it's helpful to them too, you know, and I can't always manage, you know. Sometimes I will say, could you go away? Especially if that nasty drunk man who hangs around here and pees in our garden. Sometimes I'll say, you know what, could you go away? And maybe, you know, that's not so good. Maybe it'd be better if I hung out with, like, oh, he's peeing in our garden. Zazen, great, you know. And then I don't know whether I'd have a different reaction, but I might, rather than just telling him, get the hell out of here, or I'll call the police, quit peeing on our garden, which David so carefully planted, now you're killing it. But so sometimes it's awkward, but that, you're right, each time that we can connect with that constant manifestation of thusness every moment is a moment where the teaching is being activated. So that's pretty cool, and I will try to do that.
Yeah.
Mostly against the fence.
That's where they're not, the flowers aren't growing.
Uh-huh. Against, on this side.
Oh, on that side.
On that side, yeah.
Oh, by the house pin?
By the fence between the us and the driveway.
Yeah, no. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen him peeing on like the bare spots out there. Where, yeah. Oh, Lord.
Those are the leash-free dogs.
Hmm?
Those are the leash-free dogs.
Oh, leash-free dogs, probably, yeah. Yeah. Our gate is always open. Well, so if you can stay for our short ceremony and then cookies, that would be great. And there are guest speakers in the pipeline, but as I said, they're a little further down the line because some of my favorite ones have left town. Semi-permanently or permanently, gone to Tassajara or somewhere. So bear with me. Okay. Thank you very much.